Join Alaska Public Media for its next Community Advisory Board meeting, including a discussion of the technological operations and facilities at the Elmo Sackett Broadcast Center with Alaska Public Media's Chief Technology Officer as your guide. The next meeting is in person only here at the station Wednesday, February 11th at 6 p.m. Email cab@alaskapublic.org for more information. Thank you.
Welcome to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. Dr. Margaret Merritt arrived in Alaska in 1977 to visit a friend for 2 weeks and instead got a job at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. The first ever woman to tackle a wide variety of exciting and sometimes challenging biology jobs in the state, Margaret, who also goes by Peggy, spent a career steeped in exploration and adventure in Alaska. That's a journey she details in her book, Adventures of an Alaskan Woman Biologist, and today she's going to share it with us. That's just ahead on Outdoor Explorer.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Dr. Margaret Merritt, welcome to Outdoor Explorer.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk to us today about your book and about your experience exploring Alaska. I'm really honored to have you here, and I think this is going to be a really fun conversation.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Well, your first name is Margaret, but you also go by Peggy. So when I call you that the rest of this interview, I don't want people to be confused.
So sounds good.
That's what we'll do. Okay. So today we're going to get to hear about your adventures in Alaska, your work in biology in the state, what you've learned along the way. But maybe you can start by telling us a little bit about your background. Where are you from? Tell us about that.
Well, I'm from Southern California, and my parents always took me out into the hinterlands. You know, my dad was taking photos of cacti and flower, and my mom was always taking her easel out to the mountains and painting. So even though I grew up in a congested area, we were always out exploring and rock hounding. And so I came to really feel comfortable and to love being in nature.
Yeah, yeah. How did you get into the field of biology? Because rocks are not alive. So rock hounding and biology are very different.
Well, I would have to thank my teachers for that. I was so lucky. I had really awesome teachers. In junior high, I had a biology teacher who would really do unconventional things. He'd put a rattlesnake in the refrigerator until it slowed down and then hook its fangs over the beaker to milk the poison out. And all the kids were like, ooh. And then I got to be his lab assistant and take care of a baby owl. And then our parents would get us up at 4 a.m. and we'd go on field trips to the tide pools. So Mr. Andrews made biology fun and exciting. And then in high school, I had a biology teacher who'd gone to medical school, and he pushed us to really strive, to persevere. And we were learning Latin and, I mean, dissecting cats. And he took us to the medical school in San Diego and saw them dissect cadavers. So by the time I got to college and took vertebrate anatomy, you know, that was all review. So I learned how to work hard from him. And then I had a great major professor in UC Riverside. So, yeah.
So you eventually ended up in Utah, in Logan, Utah, right? At the university there. Tell us about that. How did you end up going up to Utah for biology?
Well, at UC Riverside, I hooked up with a bunch of really adventurous women, and we planned to hike the Pacific Crest Trail. So I did the northern half of that, and then I gave a research paper on the differences between the Cascades and Sierra Nevadas. And my advisor noticed that and said, "Hey, do you want to be an assistant on a National Geographic grant working on desert bighorn?" So I said, sure. So I was really lucky to, but, you know, I was working hard too. You know, on the weekends, I'd wander out and radio track bighorn. And that got me noticed for graduate school. And I was offered a graduate position at Utah State. And then I moved over to the ecology department and got a job working with the International Biological Program, where at the time NSF was funding the modeling of ecosystems across the world. And Utah State just happened to be the center for validating desert research. So I really jumped into research 2 feet early on.
Yeah. How did you imagine? I mean, okay, so you're in Utah, you're from California. None of these places are Alaska, right? How did you imagine that career going in that moment? Like, I know that can be hard to think about, right? When people ask me to look back at my own career and answer that, I can't say I had a zillion year plan for my, you know, entire life at the time, because, you know, we're so young. But what about you? What did you think was going to happen with that?
Well, after I graduated with my master's from Utah State, I started applying for positions in the western part of the country. And, you know, there weren't very many. And the positions were a bit confined in their scope. You know, after, you know, tracking bighorn, you know, in the Santa Rosas and, you know, tromping through the Great Basin Desert, you know, the job possibilities were kind of boring. And so I didn't know really what I was going to do. A friend of mine had gotten a job up in Alaska as a float plane pilot. And he said, "Well, you should come visit." And my dad had gone to Alaska a few years earlier. And I thought, well, you know, I'd always like to see it. Why don't I just go for a 2-week vacation?
And here you are still. Okay, what I have to know, what is a boring biology job? You said some, you know, they were pretty boring. It just seems like such an interesting field to me. But of course, every field has boring parts, right? So what constitutes a boring job in biology?
Oh, being at a check station for hunters that come through the mountains. Mm. And you check, you know, to make sure they're legal, they have their license.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like kind of like the national park employees at the entrance kiosk. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a necessary job. And I'm sorry to label that as boring, but for me, you know, that wasn't prompting my curiosity.
Right. Well, I mean, you've had a very adventurous life, so maybe your bar for adventure is higher than some folks. Yeah. You answered the siren call of Alaska for more than a 2-week vacation. Okay, so tell us a little bit about that. How does a 2-week vacation become a lifetime career? Like, what's the bridge there?
Well, I always took my resume with me, and because, you know, I had it in the back of my mind, why not? And so the second day I was there, I was wandering through town, and I happened upon a fish and game office. So I walked in and said, "Hi, I'd like to talk to your biologist." And by golly, they came out, the two of them, both in game division and commercial fisheries division, and sat down at a table and started talking to me. And I was offered two jobs starting immediately.
Wow.
And I said, "Give me 20 minutes. I need to think about this." So I walked around the block and I came in and I took one of the jobs. And that started me on my career.
How old were you at that time?
This was in 1977. I was probably 25, 26.
Okay. That's a good age to have a 20-minute around the block decision that changes your life, right? Yeah, that's it. That's the perfect age for that. You know, as I read your book, it kind of struck me that, you know, of course, Alaska is not anything like Southern California. I'm from Northern California, so I can speak with some authority on that comparison, right? And it's not particularly like Logan, Utah either. So I'm wondering if there was ever a time when you first arrived, like you first took this job, maybe, you know, winter first set in, that you thought it was too much, that you maybe ever, did you ever think that you made a mistake?
No, You know, I was in the field a lot, like I explained with my parents. And then also on weekends, I go to the San Diego Natural History Museum, and they had a program for kids where we'd go hunting lizards in the chaparral, or we'd go whale watching on the ocean. I had these incredible opportunities. And then when I hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, you get to know your strengths and your weaknesses. Mm. And I think you also find out how much courage you have. Mm-hmm. And so whatever Alaska threw at me, I just always felt comfortable I could handle it.
Yeah. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bishotz, and we're talking to Peggy Merritt about her life as a biologist in Alaska and her book, Adventures of an Alaska Woman Biologist. So things were not at all then as they are now, you know, comparatively speaking, when it comes to hiring and positions within Alaska state government hiring system and fish and game. But how they were then had a big impact on your ability to string work together here. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about that challenge and how you figured that out.
Well, I arrived right when the pipeline was being constructed, and Fish and Game was having a heck of a time trying to keep technicians on staff because they kept leaving for the higher paying jobs of the pipeline. So I was really fortunate at that time where, you know, there were openings. Another situation was that the state had gotten into the habit of hiring what they called temporary employees. Mm-hmm. And this meant they didn't have to pay benefits, like no retirement or anything like that. And so that meant that these temp positions were cheaper for them. And so there were more of them. And so I got hired into a temporary position for it. It took the union, the employee union, several years to put a stop to that. Mm-hmm. So I think I came at a good time when there were openings and the ability of the state to hire people quickly and cheaply.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was single and willing to take jobs in locations that had nasty weather and, you know, out in the hinterlands, in the remote. Not everybody wanted a job like that.
Sure. Sure. Another thing that's good when you're 25, right?
Yeah.
or you know, like I think when you're for some folks who are older and, you know, listening to us who have responsibilities, myself among them, it's like a dream. You know, you look back on that with such fondness, like a dream to be able to have that freedom. You know what I mean? And Alaska's so good for that. So good for that. So in your book, you talk about your adventures. So let's talk about some adventures. What was your first memorable adventure in Alaska, and what makes it special?
Well, all of my adventures on water and air were memorable and special. But I'd say an early water adventure entailed rafting in Southeast Alaska in Endicott Arm and Ford's Terror. And this is where I began to learn lessons in understanding, reading water and navigating water, like paying attention to the tide tables. And then one of my first air adventures were aerial moose surveys in the hills on the west side of Cook Inlet, where the weather changed fast between the valleys and snow could tumble suddenly, obscuring your vision. And then we flew blind. And I had to trust the pilot to know where we were in the terrain, you know, and while we searched for a visible landmark.
Yeah. Yeah. What about being alone? You know, you mentioned in the out in the hinterland, but these are very lonely spots, maybe just you and maybe one other team member, if that. Talk about that a little bit. How does that fit into your memories of this?
You know, I don't mind being alone, and so I'm comfortable with my own company. I don't have to have a lot of people around to support me. I rely on myself and my skills and my knowledge, and I feel confident that I'm prepared. So I'm comfortable being alone, and it gives me a chance to explore and observe the nature around me.
Yeah. Yeah. How has that helped you in the rest of your life and career, that skill set of being comfortable, being alone, and using it to observe, to leverage observation?
Well, as you mentioned, I was the first woman to do many of my jobs, and that can be a lonely feeling that you're kind of, okay, I'm setting the bar, you know, women coming behind me will be judged on my performance. And, you know, there's a bit of pressure there.
Yeah.
And it's a bit lonely in that. But again, I think it's important for women in these situations to really know their subject matter, you know, be not only capable, but maybe even overqualified, so that you're comfortable in what you know and the people around you respect what you know.
Yeah. Yeah. What, by the way, what did your family think of all of this coming? You know, you said your father had come up to Alaska before and that sort of inspired you, but what did they, I mean, we're so used to these days having cell phones to call our kids being like, are you still alive? But not so much then. So what did your family think of you being out here in Alaska and doing this?
Well, my dad thought it was great. So as being an amateur photographer, I'd take pictures, you know, and send it to him, and he'd develop them and critique them and help me develop my photography skills. And mom had always been a wanderer, so, you know, and appreciated the outdoors. So they didn't mind it a bit. But as time went by, you know, mom kept saying, well, when are you going to come south?
Yeah, yeah.
But eventually, she came north. So,
yeah. Does she live here? Did she move up here?
She's passed away.
Okay.
So but she used to.
Yeah. Okay. So she relocated up to here to be with you, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I think so. And she wanted her own Alaskan adventure too.
Yeah. Yeah. What did she discover in her Alaskan adventure? And I'm sorry for your loss that she's gone.
Oh. Well, she liked, well, first of all, there were more jobs here than there were down where she was. So her first motive was to, you know, have economic security and
sure.
get a job. And then she just liked exploring. Well, she ended up in Anchorage, and she really liked exploring Girdwood and, you know, going up the mountain and, you know, traveling around South Central for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. This is Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm talking to Peggy Merritt about her book, Adventures of an Alaska Woman Biologist, and I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. So you mentioned just a few minutes ago that, you know, being the first woman to hold many of these positions and the different pressure that put on you. And that, of course, is true making waves all the time, right? But in the fish and game department specifically is where you were. Sometimes, according to your book, that came with some very real sexism and some very real challenges that weren't just, hey, I've got people coming behind me and I need to keep that in mind. These were things that impacted you personally and your success in your career. And I wanted to know if you would tell us a little bit about that, but also how you handled it.
Well, the guys would question my ability, my physical ability, and stamina to do the job. And that wasn't unreasonable. I had to prove that I could do the job so that I wouldn't compromise the mission of the project. And so when I did show that I could do the job, then any questioning on their part, you know, was allayed. And I think I enhanced my my acceptance by being really prepared. Like I said, like I would take a small engine repair class, so that if any motor that we're working with broke down, I had a toolkit and spare parts, and I knew what to do. And I'd taken several classes, like in canoeing and kayaking, so I learned better how to read water and navigate through it. I learned how to fish and hunt and trap so that, like when bears came, I knew what to do. So that I think the guys became more and more comfortable working around me. My supervisors questioned whether the stakeholders would accept me as I rose in rank and had more of a position of authority in dealing with stakeholders like the fishers, the hunters, the trappers. Mm-hmm. And really, by and large, you know, they were just fine with me. It was some of the staff that I challenged their vision of what a workplace should look like, you know, and I found this especially true working at sea, where seafaring lore and men, you know, goes back in tradition, and there haven't been very many women at sea mm-hmm. before. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes when you get in a position where you're meeting resistance, it's a fluid situation and you have to respond in different ways. For example, if there's grumbling, maybe just ignoring it and doing your job, and then, you know, people see that there's nothing to grumble about, then it dies away. In other situations, you might have to confront this and argue and say, no, that's not going to happen, you know, and be, you know, assertive. So I think you have to read the situation, also document it, and find out if you feel like your supervisor doesn't have your back, where else you can turn to for help.
Yeah. Have you seen that change in the biology field here in the state over time, but also maybe just in outdoor use in general? Like, you know, you're an outdoor user beyond your work. So have you seen that vibe change over time?
Well, I speak at universities, and mm-hmm. so I see a lot of women in the fish and wildlife and forestry and right. geology that are students and mm-hmm. wanting to enter the field more so than when I was in college 40 years ago. Mm. And of course, there are many more women biologists than there were 40 right. years ago. So the women are studying and entering the field. And you see, I think, more women athletes running marathons or right. trying, you know, yeah. Out exploring. And so, yeah, I think there are more women and minorities. I want to emphasize that, too. When I'm on campus, I'm just delighted to see different kinds of people that I never encountered before.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, your experience at the time, was that similar to what was happening in the lower 48? Or do you think that was an Alaska being behind? I mean, how was those things compared? Do you have any context for that?
I think it was comparable. I think anytime women work in a male-dominated field, you're going to have support and resistance. And when I speak on campus, both to the students and professors, they're still encountering situations where there's resistance. And that kind of surprised me when I started giving presentations on this book, because I thought, well, you know, this was 40 years ago.
Right.
But no, it's still, there's still pockets.
Yeah. Is there anything you would have done differently, looking back on how you handled that at the time and knowing everything you know now about the, you know, full situation? Is there anything you wish you had done to tackle that problem that you didn't do?
I think I handled it the best that I could.
Mm-hmm.
And I really appreciated the people who supported me in maybe sidestepping some issues or bailing altogether.
Yeah. Yeah.
On a situation, you know, there, I did receive a lot of support when others in the department realized what I was going through. So I think it just had to do with the supervisors and the culture that they create, you know. And if you get a couple of supervisors that aren't paying attention,
right,
or are quietly supporting, you know, a culture that's not inclusive, that can pose problems for people.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you see that inclusivity? I mean, you said there are more women in the field now. Do they report, you know, and you, but you do all the speaking. Do they report back that it's better than it had been?
Well, I can just speak to what I hear now. Mm-hmm. Is that some of them are still raising their hands and asking what they should do in certain situations. So
yeah,
that tells me that they're encountering it, and, you know, and whether how it compared to what I experienced, you know, I'm not really intimate with their details.
Yeah.
I just try to give them the best advice I can.
Right, right, right. Fair enough. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz, and we're talking to Peggy Merritt about her life as a biologist in Alaska, her book, Adventures of an Alaska Woman Biologist, and her adventures in Alaska, just all of them. We're going to take a short break here, and then we're going to get back to this conversation.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Today, we're talking to fish and wildlife biologist and adventurer, Peggy Merritt. She has a great book out there called Adventures of a Woman Biologist. We're talking about her experience here in Alaska and her life of adventure, you know, in the field. So, Peggy, welcome back to Outdoor Explorer. And I'm, of course, your host, Amy Bouchatz. So, Peggy, what was the best adventure you ever had over your career? I asked you about your first memorable adventure earlier, but I want to hear, like, the thing that you go back to that sticks in your mind. What do you got?
Well, I think the most important experience I had was living and working in Kotzebue, where the Arctic transformed me. I really learned how to be an Alaskan there. I learned how important the links were between the people and the land and the animals, and I learned more about the Native culture and the respect that I have for it. And I just learned a lot more about the animals and how to study them. And I mean, every job I had, I was learning and exploring and really curious to solve biological puzzles. So I love that. But I think the Arctic in particular really transformed me into an Alaskan biologist.
Mm-hmm. Mm. How many communities have you lived in Alaska, by the way?
Oh, gee, I've lived in many ecosystems, the southeast, south central, northwest, the interior.
Yeah. Is there any that you liked the most? Any particular place stick out to you that as your favorite Alaska area? I mean, I know you're in Fairbanks now, right? So maybe right. Maybe that's it because that's where you settled. But what's your fave?
Yeah, I'm gonna say I love them all. It's true. I really love the southeast rainforest and the work I did there and the people and the animals I met. And I already talked about Northwest Alaska and South Central. I had fabulous memories of working in Palmer and exploring the area. And then at the interior, it's beautiful in the fall with the birch trees. And I've loved them all. I think my most fun adventure, though, was on the Seward Peninsula, where I was in charge of surveying Arctic grayling for the summer. And so we floated 10 rivers and we looked at their growth characteristics and distribution. And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Is there an adventure you wish you could repeat? Something that you could just go back to and do again?
Well, that Seward Peninsula.
Yeah. You floated the Puritan River down there, right? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay, so since you've seen so much of the state and you love it all, but so many of us live here in South Central. I'm, of course, in Palmer, which, by the way, when I read your book and you said you were thinking about, becoming a permanent Palmer party, as it were, I was like, yes, do it. It's so great. I was cheering for past you. I know it didn't work out long term, but I'm just saying that's where my money was at. So many of us are here in South Central, right? And the road system being what it is in Alaska, it can be very challenging for most people to make it to places that are off of the road system, challenging and expensive, right? There's also like this whole situation with more space to explore than there's time to do it, right? I feel like I haven't even made a dent in the South Central area on the road system. Forget off the road system in the rest of the state, right? And I love exploring the outdoors. So I'm wondering, from your perspective, having seen so much of it, what is somewhere or where is somewhere that folks may not make a priority of getting to or going to experience or spending time in that they really should? What are people missing out on out there?
Oh, geez. Well, Kodiak is a wonderful place to go. That's pretty close to Anchorage. And yet it's like a different ecosystem. Mm. There's a different feeling to it. It's more tied to the sea, mm-hmm. It's rich in animal species, and you'll be sure to, if you're looking for wildlife, that's a good place to go. And I love the Northwest Alaska, Nome and Kotzebue, because it's a totally different climate and ecosystem, and you can see the Kobuk sand dunes. That's 25,000 square miles
yeah.
of amazing sand dunes in the Arctic and the gates of the Arctic National Park. I mean, there's so many rich places to explore.
Right. That's the problem. That's the problem. There's too many places to explore. I don't have enough time, you know. I don't have enough time or cash flow to get to all of them, and I want to, you know. That's the I guess if you're smart, you make a job out of it, huh? Become a biologist.
Right.
Pro move is what that is. What's something biology students often ask you about Alaska? Like folks who are getting ready to come up here, or maybe they're up here and, you know, preparing for field work. What do they ask?
Right. Well, I tell the students to get out of the classroom and join groups like I said, a kayak and canoe club, so you learn water, or join a fishing club, because in order to fish, you have to know what the fish are eating and how they distribute themselves through size in the stream. And or even if you don't fish, maybe just go out and observe nature. Take classes like a swimming class, or go to the gym. You need to be physically fit, not only to accomplish the mission, not, you know, to do your work, but it could save your life. So you need to be building up your outdoor skills and also your physical ability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, because the field work's not a cushy job, right? Like you're out there, you're in the elements, and you've got to be ready, yeah?
Right. You need to learn how to make a campfire and how to set up a tent. And if bad weather comes through, you need to have the right gear. There's a lot to learn outside of the classroom. And they say, well, how can we learn it? You know, like I said, well, join clubs or maybe volunteer on a project a graduate student is leading, so at least you get some experience walking around in the field.
You teaching in Fairbanks? Is that where you're teaching?
No, I was adjunct professor with the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences here at UAF for 10 years, but I haven't been in the classroom in a long time. I taught four courses over the course of 10 years. But I've really enjoyed using my book as an excuse to get back in the classroom and talk to students again. It's been really fun.
Yeah. See, there you are again with the pro tip of make the thing you want to do a job. and then you get to do it and call it work and check all the boxes at the same time. I like it. You've done an enormous amount of research and work during your career. Speaking of, what are you most proud of? What did you do that you see as having the greatest impact on you or on your field? What are you most proud of?
Well, I think I'm most proud of being the first woman research supervisor in the regulatory divisions, where I was in charge of sport fish research across the Arctic, Yukon, Kuskokwim, Upper Copper and Upper Susitna drainages, which amounted to 526,000 square miles of Alaska. Mm. And it was a huge area. And I aggressively pursued additional federal funding. And I was proud to bring in additional funding so that my budget came close to nearly $1 million. And it increased the diversity of our research scope in mm-hmm. the process. And then because I was kind of both working and teaching at the same time, I encouraged my staff and I supported them to strive for graduate degrees. And I served on their graduate committees, so that not only did our area increase, our funding increase, but the staff expertise increased. Mm. So that when I retired, I left the region in the best state it'd been since statehood in terms of scope of research, staff expertise, and funding. I'm really proud of that.
Yeah.
But I think my most tangible impact had to do with my research in Kotzebue Sound with the early life history of chum salmon and also my assignment to find a hatchery site. Mm. the state wanted to help stabilize and increase the income for commercial fishermen in Kotzebue. This was way back in 1978. And so my research on the chum salmon there, and I found a site for a hatchery. It was called Sikasuliak, that operated for 15 years and had a peak return of 90,000 chum salmon. Mm. And so I feel that that was a tangible impact to the people there, until the state got out of the commercial fish production business and closed the hatchery.
Right. I read a news story just today, actually, about the number of seafood harvesters in Alaska at new record low, you know, and last year, by the way, was the previous record low. So it's not getting better. And, you know, I was preparing to talk to you as I was reading this and just sort of thinking about your work in that and seeing that as, you know, and then, of course, juxtaposed to where we are now. And I was just like, what do you think about that when you see things like that, you know, given your experience in that field?
Well, I've seen populations that I used to study and that were thriving plummet in abundance to the point where harvest has been curtailed, like Chinook salmon on the Yukon River. When I worked on the Yukon, the Chinook salmon, you know, ex vessel value was like $4 million. And now, you know, the harvest has been shut down, or the crab harvest, the red king crab harvest in Lower Cook Inlet, that has never recovered.
Yeah. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz, and I'm here talking to Peggy Merritt about her book, Adventures of an Alaska Woman Biologist. We're talking about biology in Alaska. We're talking about adventure. We're talking about exploring. It's Outdoor Explorer. That's what we do. Maybe also I would love to know about what you've seen changed in our ecosystem, not necessarily in the biology of it and the return on fisheries and that kind of thing, but in the land, in your experience in Alaska. The population here has just exploded in your time here. And that has an impact on how we experience the outdoors and how the outdoors is there for us because of our impact on it. So I would love to know what you've noticed and maybe what you've seen with that.
Well, I tended to focus on the animals, and so I did mention a couple of examples where I've seen some populations decrease in abundance. But in terms of their ecosystems, there's been a warming, and that influences animal behavior, and some animals, their life history helps them adapt more readily to changes in their environment than others. For example, sockeye salmon can spawn in lakes. And so if you get a warming in temperature, it takes a while for a large body of water to increase. Whereas, you know, Chinook salmon can be stream spawners. And when you get higher ambient temperatures, that can quickly raise the temperature in a small stream. So I think the animals, based on their life history, have better adaptability than others, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And there's vegetation changes that occur, too, that will shift their not only distribution but feeding habits. And, well, one thing is, with the warming climate, we're having challenges in how we do field research. For example, when I was doing an aerial survey on moose, we had to have just the right conditions. We had to have snow on the ground before the bulls dropped their antlers so that you could do, a composition count. Right. But now, if snow comes later, you're not going to be able to see moose, brown moose, against a brown background. And so there's conversations going on. Well, how are we going to and do our moose surveys before the bulls drop their antlers.
So. Right, right. In fact, when I read that part of your book, I was recalling a news story about that last year, that very thing, about the challenge of that the low snow cover was hindering the moose count for that very reason. Oh, excuse me. Okay, sorry about that. What can people do about this? So you're describing the changes you see because of a warming climate. You know, this idea of global warming feels very, very big, right? From a very, like, if you're one person and looking to make a dent in something, that seems like sort of an insurmountable thing for one person to do. What do you tell people to do if they want to help preserve biology in Alaska as you've experienced it and as it has been in the past?
Well, I would say follow regulations and support your managers. You know, they're going to be scrambling to respond to the changes in the animals, their abundance and distribution and behavior as fast as they can. And when they put out a regulation, they, you know, it's helpful for people to understand why it's there and agree with it and support it.
Right, right. And not question it, you know, and complain and that kind of thing.
Right, not to ignore it,
yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Not to think it's frivolous, you know.
Right.
But, you know, people have strategic behavior. I think there's an instance in the book where I wrote about there. We were concerned about burbot harvest in one lake, and we thought, okay, well, you know, if it's too high, let's just drop the bag limit. And so the next year when the harvest survey came out, the harvest was the same. We went, well, what the heck? And as it turns out, people were taking more trips so they could get the same amount of fish. So, you know, sometimes Fish and Game makes regulations based on an assumption of human behavior, and the humans are strategic and try to, you know, work around it a bit, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's always this a bit of tug and pull going on between humans and people who are trying to predict behavior.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, we're too scrappy for them. That's what it comes down to. What do you want to do outdoors now? Now that you're retired now, yeah.
Oh yes, I'm retired.
So what do you like to do outdoors now? How do you explore Alaska today?
Well, I like to hike and walk, and I love cross-country skiing. I've actually spent so much time here that I wanted to explore other ecosystems. So last year I went mountain biking in Sedona and kayaking in Monterey Bay. But I always love coming back and getting back into Alaska. And I probably should revisit some of the areas I haven't been to a while.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when people hear this, it'll be, I think, we'll be in the deep winter, and getting to Sedona is going to sound real good. So, yeah, future me is interested in that prospect for sure. So no judgment here at all. As a professor and leader in the biology field, I know you encounter a lot of people who are new to the state. You spoke about biology students specifically earlier, but not everyone's a biology student who's getting out for field work. Maybe some of us are getting out just for adventures or exploring Alaska. What do you tell folks about making it here, about surviving and thriving in the way that you did? You know, you learned to like it.
You need the right gear for whatever activity you're doing, so you're not miserable, because you're going to encounter perhaps sudden changes in extreme weather. And so you need to have the right gear, and you need to have some background information on the activity you're doing. So if you're going to go out hiking, be a bit prepared for mosquitoes or bears or navigating, so you have a map, or a sat phone or something. Educate yourself in how to be in the outdoors and have the right gear.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you ever encounter people who hear your story and are like, wait, biology, that's the thing for me, and maybe are a little bit later in their outdoor adventure life? And if so, what do you tell them?
Oh, you know, you mean you're asking if people...
they hear you talk about field work and biology and they decide that that's the thing they want to do. You know, do you have any advice for folks who are thinking about getting into that based off of what they've heard from you?
I would encourage them to pursue it and to get an advanced degree. I think there's fewer jobs, less funding, so it's more competitive. But to be open to diverse opportunities is a stepping stone. You know, once you get in, then you get building up your reputation that, oh yeah, this person can do well in the field, and you get some recommendations, and then you can go on from there. So, again, be really knowledgeable in your field, and it's okay to be overprepared in terms of not only your ability to work outside, but also what you're studying about the animal or your ecosystem.
Yeah. You have a doctorate, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. Why did you decide to do that? If I understand this correctly, it was not necessary for your career, you know, for sure, right? Although you certainly have used it. Why did you decide to go through the challenge of doing that?
Well, my boss at the time, Dr. John Clark, encouraged me. And I thought that at the time it would help me in my new job as a research supervisor. It would help me do my job better. So I had support from my boss and my husband and and I had the motivation, and because I wanted to do a good job.
Yeah.
I'm really, it was a lot of hard work. It took 5 years, you know, I was pregnant at the time, so I had a new baby, I had a full-time job, and I was working on a PhD. So I didn't have a lot of spare time for 5 years, but I'm really glad I did it because I feel it did help me in my job. I specifically focused on decision analysis and in terms of how to solve complex problems in fisheries. I mean, you could apply it to anything, but
yeah.
In terms of fisheries, and since then, I've helped people try to understand really complex issues like the stellar sea lion pollock controversy, or even just doing a strategic plan for salmon research and management. There could be 100 different moving parts in that whole problem.
Right.
And so I was interested in contributing to people coming together and learning from each other and solving some problems.
Yeah. This is Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. I'm talking to Peggy Merritt about her book, Adventures of an Alaska Woman Biologist, and about biology fieldwork in Alaska. You just described being pregnant and working and doing your PhD at the same time. Now, I am a mom as well. I've got two teenage sons and a very packed schedule. I think it's a little cringe when people ask, oh, how do you do it all, right? But at the same time, I always want to know how the person I'm talking to balanced everything, because it's something that I struggle with, right? That I want to spend time outside and have my career and have my kids and be an outdoor adventure seeker and lover. But it's hard to make it all happen. And so I'm wondering, can you share your wisdom with me and everyone else? How did you do it all?
Well, I had triple backup childcare.
That's good. that helps. I'm a big fan of the people who drive my son to his ski practice, for example. That alone is such a huge help sometimes. So I hear you.
Right. So if the first, second, and third failed, then I would just go pick my daughter up and bring her to the office and install her in a little desk in the corner and or take her with me to graduate meetings. So, and I had supportive supervisors who allowed a certain degree of flexibility. there, you know, there at that time, there wasn't a lot of, they weren't used to parents bringing children concerns into the workplace. Now, I think there's a lot more men and women who try to juggle childcare and work at the same time. And so I think some systems have been worked out, but it was kind of new for people at the time. Or sometimes, you know, I would just have to take a day of leave if everything fell apart. And right. I had a supportive husband. So we just made it work.
Yeah, that's kind of how I always feel too. Like, I don't know how I did it all, but it did. So, but it happened and we're fine, right? And happy. What does your daughter do today? She's grown. So what does she do today?
She's a wildland firefighter.
Okay. So the being outdoors and a part of your research and experience became part of her life experience and part of what shaped her into being who she is, as you would expect it to be. Yeah.
Yeah. She had a lot of experience growing up, being in the outdoors. She met the challenges with, courage and decided she liked working outdoors and looked around and settled on fighting fire.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think that's one of the things about being a parent who is, you know, quote unquote, doing it all with career and also spending time outside and melding those two things when you can. And it goes back to something that you said earlier about towards the beginning of our time about building toughness. And knowing that if you can tackle XYZ challenge, you can do other challenges. It's all transferable. It all makes you better in some areas than you were before. You know, I feel like, okay, I know that I can maybe tackle this big run. I do ultra running. Tackle this long distance because I have, you know, tackled this big challenge in my work and vice versa, right? Like I know that I can do this hard thing outside because I have done these other hard things before, inside and outside. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Once you face life and death situations and you overcome it, you say, okay, I've lived through that. You know, usually anything else that comes my way, I can deal with after that. And if you go to the bottom of the well again and again and pull out your last ounce of strength to complete what you're doing, you know, okay, I can do just about anything. Yeah. I mean, you have to know your limits and you have to be prepared. I want to say that over and over again to people who go into the field, be prepared. I think encountering, situations where you have to stretch yourself and your limits gives you confidence that you can handle what's going to come your way.
Yeah. For folks who maybe read your book after hearing us talk today, what's one thing, what do you want them to take away? What do you want them to take away from your adventures and your story?
I'd like them to feel entertained and I would like them to learn a whole lot about animals and how biologists study them and our attempts to manage them for the benefit of the community's well-being. And I hope that they feel inspired to go on their own adventures and to persevere in following their dreams, you know, attaining their goal.
Right. Yeah. Peggy Merritt, thank you so much for joining us on Outdoor Explorer today. It's been a delight talking to you.
Oh, thanks, Amy. I'm really glad you asked me to join you.
Thanks so much for joining us for Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Amy Bouchatz. A special thanks to our guest, Dr. Margaret Merritt, and to our producers, Tobin Shelby, with help from Ammon Swenson. We could not do this show without them. And from all your hosts here at Outdoor Explorer, we'll see you outdoors.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. Tobin Shelby is its producer, and the program is edited by Ammon Swenson and Crystal Hyde. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed on the show are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can listen to Outdoor Explorer anytime at alaskapublic.org and in your favorite podcast app. If you have a question, comment, or a topic suggestion, email outdoorexplorer@alaskapublic.org.